Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Thank you for joining us. Hope your footy team won for those gearing up for the season. Trust the rest of you were able to take an hour or so just to relax and recoup for the weeks that's to come. It's Palm Sunday today. Many people were off to church. Many people in church heard about Jesus coming into the city of Jerusalem on the colt, the foal of an ass. It's said to be indicative of the kingdom to come. That is, here comes Jesus bringing the good news to Jerusalem, the holy city, and people saw him as coming to bring a kingdom of justice. And it's justice that concerns us this evening. In the past week, both the government and the opposition have found that they can agree on at least one thing, that part of the Northern Territory intervention regarded as most problematic for civil liberties will be extended to the rest of Australia following an evaluation commencing in July. The extension has the dual advantage of avoiding the need to suspend the Racial Discrimination Act and is seen as tough on welfare recipients in an election year when both sides need to show they are not wimps when it comes to welfare. What it risks is stigmatisation of a far broader group in our community. Benefit recipients could have up to half their income quarantined and be issued with a basics card for necessary purchases such as rent, food, utilities and clothing in designated stores. And here is where some fear such a policy risks getting nasty. Such a system would immediately tell the world that the bearers could not be trusted to manage their own money. This is the whip of stigmatisation, so beloved of some of the nastiest regimes of the past century. What is somewhat ironic about this measure is that it's being supported by both sides of politics led by conscientiously Christian leaders. Yet the opposition, such as it is coming from the churches and the very welfare agencies of those churches to which our leaders belong. The Catholic, Anglican, Salvation Army and Uniting Church Welfare Arms all spoke against the notion at a Senate committee of inquiry held recently. There are some church agencies who have given the idea some support, notably the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence in Melbourne, but they've declined invitations from the ABC and this program to participate in discussions on the issue. So this evening, we're going to be joined shortly by two agencies who have strong links to the church and a long history of engagement in welfare policy, Anglicare and St. Vincent de Paul. They'll be joining us shortly, and we'll take your calls. It's an issue that I'm sure many of you will have views on, and you can join in the discussion. Perhaps the discussion will help clarify what's intended and begin to raise some public concerns about perhaps the good and the bad of welfare intervention and particular income management. It's my pleasure to introduce this evening the Executive Director of Anglicare in Australia, Casey Chambers, and John Falzon from St. Vincent de Paul. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, John.
You both have heads of organisations which have been looking at this issue for some time. Casey Chambers, Anglicare, put in a submission to a Senate inquiry on the whole issue of income management. We first heard about it, of course, with the intervention in the Northern Territory last year. There were criticisms that this required suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act because it was discriminating against one group of people. Now the government is proposing, okay, well, look, it's worked so well, we'll extend it to welfare recipients across the nation. How is this proposal going to be sort of refined and worked out so it spreads to everybody? I mean, just what's being proposed here?
Well, John, I'm probably not the best person to talk of that because those particular details of where to from here haven't really become very clear. And certainly a lot of organisations that did present to the Senate inquiry, that was the focus of some of their concerns. So we're interested in how it is going to roll out and when. We know that the bill was due for discussion this last week and it got left off. So we're wondering where that's going. But I guess the real issue is how it's going to affect how we feel about people on welfare and how it's going to affect how those people feel about themselves.
John Falzon, have you heard any sort of more specific proposals about what's going to be contained in the measures?
Without wishing to talk about the lack of detailed programmatic specificity here.
far be it from me to ask of it.
Indeed. What we are aware of is that, number one, compulsory income management was imposed, of course, as part, as you said in your intro, as part of the Northern Territory Emergency Response, usually known as the intervention. It was imposed, let's call a spade a spade, it was imposed on the basis of race. It was imposed on the basis of Aboriginality and a certain area. Of course, part of its imposition required the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act. Now the government wishes to reinstate the Racial Discrimination Act and...
Yes, well, it looks a bit smelly if we suspend it, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. But as far as the St Vincent de Paul Society is concerned, it looks a bit smelly if you reinstate it by, rather than removing the problem, extending the problem so that it is imposed not on the basis of race alone, but on the basis of class, i.e. on the basis of particular social security payments, New Start, youth allowance, and parenting payment. So this to us is of grave concern. We know that the plan is to roll that out on the basis of class within the Northern Territory, and then our understanding is that the possibility will be there to roll it out on the basis of locational disadvantage, as the government calls it.
It could be selected by postcode, could it?
Exactly.
So your postcode could be declared a quarantine area.
Exactly. So what that will mean is anyone residing in that postcode who finds themselves unemployed for a certain period of time will automatically have compulsory income management imposed on them. Now, the government has been quick to say that there are opt-out provisions, but our position is this. Why treat people as if they are guilty until proven innocent? Why place the onus on individuals to demonstrate that they are somehow worthy to manage their own income? Our position isn't a radical one, really. We're really within the community sector, all of us, trying to be voices of moderation, because we see that the current model that is being proposed by the government and supported, of course, by the opposition is extreme. And the Northern Territory Emergency Response Task Force, in its report to the final report to government in 2008, made the recommendation, and I quote, that at some point income management should become voluntary. We believe that now is that opportune time for it to become voluntary. For those who say, well, it actually really works well for some people, we have absolutely no quarrel with that.
Well, in fact, there already is a provision called centrepay, isn't there, where people can have their income managed voluntarily.
Precisely. And we would say that where it is working well for somebody, let them continue with it as a choice, as an empowering choice that is where people decide that this is a very useful tool. But that's a very, very different kettle of fish to saying we, the government, in a paternalistic manner, are deciding that this is good for you. Regardless of your circumstances, we think you have to do this. For a government and an opposition that declare themselves as being anti-welfarist, not wishing to promote welfarism, I would have to say that this is welfarism in the extreme. It is making people more dependent, less empowered, less able to control their own lives. And I thought that this was something that none of us really wanted as a society.
Casey Chambers, let's talk for a moment still about who this is going to affect and how. I understand from what I've been able to read that it's going to be implemented for everybody in the area currently covered by the intervention as it affects Aboriginal people. So everybody in that area will come under its sway from July, and that then will lead to a testing period, and from that period an evaluation will be made about rolling out to the rest of the country. Is that your understanding of the way it's going to work?
Yes, it is. And it's, as John said earlier, it's going to pick up people on certain benefits. I mean,
well, let's talk about who is covered then. Who do you understand will be caught up in this net?
Well, it'll be anybody on youth allowance, single parenting payment or New Start who's been on that payment for a certain amount of time, and that's 3 or 6 months depending on the payment. As you say, in a particular area. We haven't had any clarification on how those areas will be picked, whether it'll actually be down to postcodes or areas that the minister decides are experiencing locational disadvantage. But if you are on one of those payments in those areas, then you will get caught up in this.
And I understand there's a category too where you could be deemed vulnerable, and so that could be a sort of pretty well a catch-all, really, couldn't it?
Trump. Well, that's right, Bill, although it's pretty much a catch-all anyway if you're in one of those areas. So yeah, you could be travelling along quite fine and get brought into this. We have been, Anglicare Australia made a submission. We're perhaps a little more nuanced than some of our other colleagues in the sector in that we do agree that there's an issue. Our services daily work with people who are living very chaotic, very vulnerable lives, and that makes any children, particularly in their care, extremely vulnerable. So we don't disagree that there is an issue. We also don't necessarily disagree that income management is a useful tool if it's part of a bag of tools. We would like to see people being able to volunteer into it, but certainly we'd want to see it time limited, a bit of a circuit breaker for some families. We would want to see that a raft of services comes in to support people on it. We don't believe it's enough to simply manage the quarantining. We actually think that other services should come in behind it. We work with these families and it hasn't taken them a matter of weeks to get into the situation where they are. It's been lifetimes sometimes. There are housing issues, there are issues of substance abuse, there are issues of mental health, there are issues of deep and long-term social exclusion. I'd also really like to flag the idea that we don't believe that we can have this discussion about how benefits are doled out, if you like, without actually having at least a side word about adequacy. And I know John will agree with us here. We really think that we've got to look at the adequacy. 43% of people who came to our Anglicare Sydney's emergency relief services in the last quarter had children in their household. So we can see that people really are struggling. Vouchers that are given out for help with Telstra bills through emergency relief services, the 34% of those go out to people who are on disability support pension. So clearly we've got to have a conversation about adequacy. We often hear politicians from both sides saying that they could live on $456 a fortnight, and we all could. We shouldn't be talking about that. We should be talking about that as an annual income. We can all do that for a week. Of course we can, because we've got full pantries. We've got cars that are insured. We've got children whose medication is up to date. But if you think about living on $11,800 a year for a number of years, clearly things are going to go wrong. So we really think we've got to have a debate about adequacy as well.
John Falzon, this broadening it just for a moment, picking up on what Casey said about adequacy, this does go to the government's attitudes towards welfare, and it's shared amongst government and opposition. Both have been proud to claim the figures that have come out through the OECD and elsewhere that Australia runs one of the most efficient welfare services in the world. It could be a bit of a bleak boast, could it not, in this context? I mean, how is one measuring efficiency here?
Yeah, I would have to say those measures are to do with payments being well targeted And to some degree, that is quite correct. I completely endorse Casey's comments about income adequacy having fallen very, very much behind, particularly for people experiencing unemployment and sole parents. This was something that caused all of the community sector great pain at the last federal budget, to see basically that wedge being further driven between the so-called deserving and undeserving poor, which I know was the subject of one of your program a couple of weeks ago, John. But to us, to turn around and say, rather than addressing the inadequacy of your payments, we will put the burden on you to demonstrate how you can better manage the payments, the meagre payments you receive, I would have to call that offensive in the extreme. The people that we see are extremely clever and creative managers of those meagre incomes in most instances, and the reality is that it simply isn't enough. You spoke about people being deemed vulnerable under the new legislation and therefore again falling under this blanket imposition, and of course make no mistake, as far as we are aware, this can apply to the categories of social security payments that we have not mentioned, such as aged pension as well. But here's the incredible contradiction. A person might be deemed vulnerable because they are having trouble, for example, paying their bills, paying the rent. And so the assumption is that the fault is with them rather than with the adequacy of the income they are receiving. This goes to the heart of what the government likes to call social inclusion. We consider this to be a highly exclusive means.
It pushes some people out of the mainstream.
Exactly.
This
marginalises people further. It stigmatises people. As we both, Casey and I both agree, for some people, this tool can be an excellent choice as long as it is in the context of other supports and resources, which at the moment are sadly lacking.
But
have it imposed is really stigmatising and degrading for people.
Let's go to some of the reasons why people may wish to support this and why there has been, it seems, bipartisan support from both government and opposition. One has been the need in some areas in the Northern Territory for an intervention, albeit initially through child abuse cases and then through sort of petrol sniffing, other things. The examples, the horror stories have led the charge here. I guess one can counter that with the old aphorism, hard cases make bad law. But nevertheless, people have seen where, in particular cases, such a thing has been necessary and it wouldn't have come voluntarily. Now, surely there are ways in which the benefits of that are being seen by many, many people in Australia as common sense. Hence, both parties seem to favour it. They're picking up on a certain resonance with the Australian community, are they not, Casey?
Well, I think unfortunately there's always a bit of resonance in making people work for any money. But the majority of us get up early, we sit on public transport or in traffic jams, and some people don't like to think that other people get money for nothing. I think the days of the dole, lodging, surfing holiday and well and truly over with the levels that we have. But certainly at Anglicare, our submission was about the fact that there are some people for whom life is very difficult, but we don't feel that this measure alone is going to necessarily turn things around. The other thing we should talk about is that it is going to be a little bit expensive. I'm not sure how we would be judged on efficiency of welfare system once we get this in, because it seems to be a little bit the wrong way around, assuming that people need this treatment and they can actually then apply to be taken out of it. So there may be a difficulty there. I had it put to me yesterday that in Anglicare trying to get it to be more targeted, it could be more deeply stigmatising for those who do come into it. And I thought that through, but I really thought, well, prison's stigmatising, but we don't get around that stigma by putting more people in prison. So we would certainly support a more targeted version. I think that people I think it's popular for people for a couple of reasons. The other thing for us is that we have service providers who feel that it's a good thing, not necessarily in its current form though, but that they would see that something that is targeted, that people have to work their way into. They actually have to fall through a few holes to get there. And once they're there, the income management is part of it. But we do have service providers who are working with families who would see that is actually useful.
But that sort of model that you're just talking about there requires pretty intensive case management, and that would add to the expense, would it not? That would make such a program really expensive.
Well, we didn't get any figures in the Senate inquiry, but some sums that we've done from the media releases would indicate that it's going to cost $4,400 or so. And as I say, we're just trying to do these sums from media releases. $4,400 per person per year just to administrate it. Now, if we do a blanket sort of approach, let's say we get 100, we capture 100 people, let's say only 20 would go in under our suggestions, there's a lot of savings there. One person suggested to me that an analogy was like supposing that the suburb that you currently live in, a lot of drivers from there have car accidents, and so the whole of that suburb is asked to be home by 7 p.m. and not allowed to leave by 6 a.m. and a curfew. And we can imagine the kind of anger that would put on us. It would also de-skill us in nighttime driving, and that's the other thing. We want to make sure that this is time-limited, that it is backed up with other skill bases around financial counselling, around budgeting, around whatever the issue is that people are dealing with. As I said earlier, housing, substance abuse, long-term unemployment, long-term social exclusion, all these types of issues. We need to actually mend those things if these people aren't going to be in this situation for a long time.
This goes back. You're suggesting this takes us back to the very paternalism which social welfare has been trying to avoid for the last 30 years.
Well, I do think, look, we've got more and more children coming into out-of-home care. Anglicare services in every state see work in that area. The costings of out-of-home care, the latest Productivity Commission found them, they range from $31,000 to $72,000 per annum, and yet we know that those children have lesser outcomes across a broad range of issues than children who grow up in their own family homes. So it certainly is something that we need to avoid to actually protect those most vulnerable, those children.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia and via the web to the world. We're talking about a matter which could become something of national contention if implemented in the way that many welfare agencies feel. That is the idea of income management, that those deemed to be unable to control their spending of the welfare benefits they received should have them managed for them. Cards issued to people to be spent only in designated stores and I guess the whip of stigmatisation used as another form of getting people to conform to what society expects of them when they receive the largesse of the society. John Falzon, before we take some calls, there's one other point, I guess, in asking why this is seen by both parties as something that would be politically acceptable. There's a sort of perverse egalitarian logic involved here, isn't there? That is, taking it from a sort of good old Labor egalitarian view, we're all equal, and I'm no better than the next man or anybody else, and if I can better myself unaided, then so should everybody else. And if they're not doing it, so it must have more to do with their attitude than their ability. Hence, we should manage it. It's a sort of perverse egalitarianism.
Well, perverse is the key word here, in my opinion, John. What people fail to recognise when they jump to those conclusions, and I don't blame any members of the public for thinking that way, because I think that that kind of discourse is deeply inculcated in all of us, a sense of anyone can make it if they really try. But of course, the obverse to that assumption is that if you're not making it, it's because you're not trying. And the truth is that that this is simply not the case. There aren't many choices to be made between a rock and a hard place. And it really is not only incorrect, but inherently unjust to blame people for their own disadvantage, to really hone in on their so-called dysfunctionality, rather than asking the questions, why have people historically, structurally, been pushed to those margins where they simply cannot cope? What are the real causes? My proposal is, and it's not mine alone, but for people who have really tried to learn from those who are experiencing disadvantage, it is very clear to us that the deficit, the incapacity, the problem is not inherently with the individual. It is with the kind of society that creates and exacerbates that that level of inequality. Now, you have two ways of furthering these this train of thought. One is to pathologize individuals, to paint them as being somehow sick. The other is to criminalize, to engage in a moral discourse which says they are bad. To extend that, of course, you go then and say it's not just the individuals, it's entire communities. John Howard, whilst Prime Minister, gave a very interesting speech at the Westin Hotel in Sydney, where he spoke about the zones of chaos in Australian society, the zones of chaos in young people's lives. And in many ways, this was an interesting preamble, if you like, to the intervention that was going to come later, because that was entirely about the construct of a zone of chaos that needed order, with all the symbolism that that carries with it. This really follows from a US academic by the name of Lawrence Mead, who spoke of the need for a close supervision of the poor. I would put it to you, John, and to all of the listeners, that this way of talking about the poor as a them, as an other, as an alien group in our midst, is hurtful, it's unfair.
And whenever it's been tried in the past, certainly in the 20th century, led to some very unfortunate outcomes.
Yes, it does nothing for really building a fair society and a sense of that we're in this together. There is no us and them. It's got nothing to do with trying to achieve justice, or even at a very practical level, it's got nothing to do with really helping people to be self-sufficient. In the case of compulsory income management, I would put it this way: it's taking a somewhat useful tool and turning it into a rather hurtful weapon.
Compulsory income management is our topic this evening. What do you think of the idea? You better get your head around it, because the government could be implementing it in an area near you in the not-too-distant future. Am I scaremongering? Well, take a look at what's proposed. It's an election year, folks. Perhaps it's all hot air and something in wind, as some would say, but perhaps it's not. 1-300-800-222. Give us a call. 1-300-800-222. Tell us what you think of the government's proposal, supported by the opposition, to extend the Northern Territory intervention as far as income management goes to the rest of Australia. Tested in the Northern Territory in general after July, and then perhaps rolled out to the rest of Australia to a postcode near you, perhaps. 1-300-800-222 is the number to ring. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia and via the web to the world. David is on the line. Hello, David. How are you doing?
I was just going to offer a situation that I'm aware of with a lady who owned her own house. Her husband died and she wound up on income support with two kids.
Yep.
Eventually, the council sold her house for unpaid rates. She took the remainder of the money, some $150-odd thousand, fed it through the pokies in just on 18 months. And now she and her kids live on her brother's doorstep. Now, I understand what everybody's saying about, in general, this may not be the best plan, but if you can narrow down who does need it, by God, they really do need it.
Yes, Casey, there's a very good example of the sorts of things that people will want to talk about.
That's right, and we're certainly, I think I said at the very start, we see families who are living extremely impoverished lives. There's a poverty of money, but there's also a paucity of opportunity and aspirations. And we certainly see for people and understand that sometimes it's easier to go to the pokies, to imbibe alcohol, to do other things which we say are not appropriate. That's particularly so when there are children involved. I mean, we could almost turn this on its head and say that people in Australian society deserve more than just a few bits of money once a fortnight. We actually do have an obligation to provide services and to look after people and to make the best effort to help them turn their lives around.
At the risk of interjecting,
money
was never the issue with this particular person. The money was there. She blew the money with a gay abandon.
Yes, John.
Two points. First of all, it sounds like the money that the lady fed through the pokies, in fact, was not money that she had received from the government. Is that the case, David?
That is the case. But the reason she had that money is because, To define the situation a little more, we had three pensioners and two children living in one house that couldn't actually manage to pay the rates. The income they had in their house was greater than the income I had in mine working as a full-time employed person. They couldn't pay their rates for a period of 8 years. It wasn't due to a lack of income. It was due to a lack of being able to direct that income, in some cases at least, where it should go. And in the end, the people who suffered as a result are going to be her children.
Yeah, absolutely. The point is, however, that in that lady's case, it's a really interesting example, that money that went down the tube, that would not have been income managed. And so,
even under the new regime.
That's right, yeah. Because under the new regime, we're talking about managing, quarantining, 50% is generally assumed the proportion of the social security payments that the government makes to a family or an individual. So my point is this: I'm not in any way disparaging the example. I think, in fact, it's a really good one, because no two examples are the same, and sometimes they defy all patterns. But my point is, this would be a very blunt tool to impose, even in a case like that. And I would put to you, David, that you're absolutely right. This is a tragedy, and there are so many tragedies just waiting to happen in similar circumstances. But let us look at what can really work to address the causes of, in this example, problem gambling. In other examples, alcohol or drug abuse. I'm not convinced, and the government is yet to provide any evidence to suggest that this approach actually addresses the causes of those problems.
That it has no therapeutic benefit.
No, I'm not for a moment disputing the harsh realities, the harsh outcomes, and as Casey said, particularly for children in families where there are enormous problems, but I would have to ask whether, particularly when it is by itself, whether it goes anywhere near addressing the problems that it purports to solve.
David, you've raised a terrific example, and I'm sure people are going to use it as the discussion goes on for the rest of the evening. We've got lots of calls on the board, so I may have to move on.
Have a good night.
Good on you. Thanks very much.
David. Thanks, David.
All the best. We'll take a call from Mark in Wollongong. Hello, Mark. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, what would you like to say?
I like most ideas, there's always good and bad or pros and cons to it. I would have thought maybe a mixture of the idea where some money is given and used however it needs to be, however the individual wants to, and then a certain amount of money is proportioned to other necessities. Then the person who's receiving it gets the benefit of both. They're not being stigmatised, but they're also getting the necessities that they need.
Casey.
I think you're right, Mark. Our biggest issue with this is that it is a blanket approach. So we do see that it's wasting quite a bit of money administering this system for people who don't need it, that takes money out of the system that would enable us to case manage people that do need it. A lot of our services that really do go to some of these, as John said, the causes, things like Communities for Children, those kind of services are actually a lot cheaper to run than this kind of costing would suggest. So we're certainly at Anglicare not wimping out. We're not saying that there aren't people for whom life is very difficult and for whom perhaps they're not able at the moment to take the best care of their children. But what we're actually saying is if we get this right, then we will have made significant improvements. We're not actually saying that we're absolutely against conditionality. But if we don't get it right, we'll have wasted an opportunity to do something different, to actually put the right level of conditionality and support, most importantly support, in there. We understand that the conditionality is important to voters, it's important to lots of people, but we think it's support that's going to make it important to make sure that these people aren't just coming back to the same system year in and year out.
I'm sure that everyone would agree that conditionality is only one part of it, and that if we didn't need to have it, that would be great. So, but to the education side of it is what we're looking for. But whether that happens, how you do it, you know, I just thought a mixture of the two might be a good compromise.
Thanks for your thoughts, Mark. We will have to move on. Casey, you want to make one final observation?
I was just going to say, Mark could be writing our submission for us almost, because that really is what we're saying, that, you know, the conditionality brings people into it, but it's really the support that we put around it that turn out at the end of the time a very different skilled up family.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. We're talking about a proposal supported by both government and opposition to introduce compulsory income management across Australia, a proposal to be tested in the Northern Territory in July or following July, and then perhaps rolled out across the country. But mind you, it is an election year and both parties are supporting it. Our studio participants this evening are Casey Chambers, the Executive Director of Anglicare Australia, and John Falzon, Executive Officer of the St Vincent de Paul National Council in Australia, and of course you. Let's go to Anne in Western Australia. Hello, Anne. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, hi, John. I have lived in the Territory, and I think, you know, garnishing the wage in some cases has helped the people in the town camps in particular, in Alice Springs, where, you know, they lived in such crowded conditions and young people were locking their food in boxes and all sorts of things because, you know, everyone would be humbugging. And now it seems to be that they are doing better with their food, you know, and being able to equalise it a bit. You know, it depends on the situation where people are living. I mean, there are some women who didn't have children who had their money taken. Well, they're in a position they didn't need to have it taken. But, you know, I think this, what that man was saying before is right. It depends on the circumstances. How they arrange it, I don't know.
Yes, this is the real concern then that this could be too much of a blunt instrument.
Yeah, but I think too, you've got to look. I've taught in little schools in the Territory too where you didn't know who was getting the money for the people. And there were some women who were looking after five or six kids and they probably weren't getting the money for them. So they were out of pocket. There have been so many situations. It's a very big problem when you actually live in the communities to see who's responsible for them. And grandmas often, I'd hate to be a grandma because they've had terrible burdens, you know, left with children and then they didn't get the money and it's been a very big problem.
What's your instinct?
I think perhaps still keep it going And maybe in normal families too, because, and maybe have some training. You know how banks went in up at Hopewell years ago and helped people with their, teach them money. And I think the Commonwealth Bank's got something now for children, even if we could introduce it into schools where we could teach children a little bit more about what it's for, not just get $20 and go and spend it. Yeah, look at what they're doing. I mean, some people aren't good at budgeting. I'm not particularly good, so I feel sorry for people who are told how to do it, you know, like, but I think if people could help them in it by education in a way with having courses and, you know, just little things like that, where even in the community I'm at the moment, there are about 20 people who want to get a driver's licence. Well, this is a common need, you know. But how are they going to do it? There's nothing here, you know?
Mm.
There's lots of things that we can do to help people and they get independence and then learn a bit more, you know?
Mm. Thanks for your observations, Anne. John, did you want to respond to anything, Anne?
Yeah, look, thank you so much, Anne. I really liked what you said about education, actually, and the descriptions you gave of life in the camps makes me think of the need to really look at, as you said, the circumstances, the conditions in which people are forced to live. Of course, it's a matter of grave concern historically that we as a nation have let this situation persist and get even worse. I believe it is a matter of great national shame that we have allowed that level of inequality to fester in our midst and then to blame individuals. I really appreciated what you said about people learning in order to move on despite the terrible conditions in which they're being forced to live on the margins of society. And it just reminded me of one of my favourite quotes from Professor John McKnight, who said that revolutions begin when people who are defined as problems achieve the power to redefine the problem. I love that quote because it says to me, it speaks such hope that, you know, here we are as a nation defining individuals and households and even, you know, shame on us, the first peoples of our country, as problems, and yet the real engine for social change happens when the people who are defined as the problems actually are empowered to change, to redefine the problem and to teach all of us. That's what it's all about, in my opinion. It's not just a matter of fixing a few people's lives. It's a matter of all of us as a nation learning from the tragedies and injustices in our midst. So thank you very much for your offering tonight, Anne.
I enjoy the show, John.
Thanks Anne.
So much. Goodbye.
Lovely to talk to you. All the best. Bye-bye. Bye. Let's go to Jill in Canberra, who has a few observations. Hello, Jill. How are you?
Oh, hi, everyone. Look, I just wanted to support the thrust of the conversation so far and just make a couple of points about practicalities. The first is that many low-income people only get by buying food and other things on the cheap, for example, through local suppliers or when the markets close or small shops on sale. And they certainly can't afford to buy everything at supermarket or major stores. So something like this would actually make people worse off. And the second point I wanted to make was that the list of payments that are affected by the income management in the Northern Territory includes payments such as family tax benefit. And a lot of high-functioning people, including a lot of public servants and no doubt some of the politicians' staffers, would be getting such payments. And does that, if they're proposing that, you know, the Northern Territory income management system be extended elsewhere, does that mean that they don't trust their own staff?
Casey.
Thanks, Jill. That's excellent. And it's certainly something we've talked a lot about. We've talked a lot about it, a lot in our submission, in our newsletters, which is, let's not forget, that this dichotomy, this false dichotomy between taxpayers and welfare recipients is totally false, like a lot of dichotomies. Most people at some stage in their life receive some kind of welfare from the state. And I think we should clean up this word. It's being used as a dirty word, but welfare has some wonderful roots. We're talking about the faring well of our whole community. And it's lovely, too, to think that and to remind people that family tax benefit, A and B, it's a welfare payment. And as Jill says, it's available to some very well-off families. So we've certainly been talking about family tax benefit, age pension, those kind of pensions, which seem to fall into that area of your recent programme on deserving and undeserving poor. And certainly there is some kind of schism in the welfare payments that really tells us something about what we think about worthiness and unworthiness.
Yeah, perhaps we could sort of garnish the top end as well as the bottom end.
Well, that's what I was just thinking about, John, actually, the welfare that goes to the big end of town, lest we forget. And gee whiz, I wonder what sort of conditionality we place on that.
Jill, thanks for your call. We'll move on. Patrice in Queensland is on the line. Hello, Patrice.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
I've just got something to say. Like, I live in a small town where there is no lack of opportunity whatsoever for people who are able to work but receive, for want of a better word, welfare payments. And I don't understand why they shouldn't be issued ration cards. For instance, my neighbours here, they are the people that are able to work but choose not to. I've heard them talk about it with their friends. And the thing is, they have, parties on weekends, buy alcohol, buy things, and they wear, like, the clothes that they wear, are not suitable clothes. They're in tatters, and they choose to buy alcohol and have parties when I have to get up and work at 6 o'clock the next morning, and yet they choose not to work. So I don't understand why, they have children. I don't understand why we shouldn't issue them ration cards or as such to get groceries so that at least their children are well fed and well clothed.
Yes, the point about the children is one that's been consistently made, Casey, on this issue.
That's right, and that's really where we've come from as Anglicare when we've said that there are times when this kind of programme is valid, when we are looking at children, when we're looking at families laying down the pattern for those children's lives. And this certainly, that sort of that example that Patrice's neighbours certainly sounds like the type of example that Minister Macklin is targeting. Now, of course, one of the problems is that I don't know which town that is, and I'm sure Patrice doesn't want to tell us, and she doesn't need to. But the fact is, if that town isn't highlighted by the minister, then these people won't get picked up by that. Yeah. And that comes back yet again to, I'm sorry to sound like a broken record on this, but to that blanket approach of, I'm sure it won't be as crude as postcodes, but, we can talk about it that way. So the fact, our suggestion is that we need to be working with the government to work out how we better target it and how we bring things in behind that to help those people understand the effect that that type of lifestyle is having on young children and how we actually help them understand how to have a lifestyle that's going to give those children a better foundation for life.
Folks, we've run out of time. We're just getting started. Lots of calls on the board. I'm sorry, you're going to have to ring back everybody in a couple of hours' time when we open up the chat room. John Falzon and Casey Chambers, you've exhausted our time very quickly this evening. It's a discussion that I believe will have a great resonance across the community once people begin to realise that the political parties are serious about it. So thanks for coming in this evening and just kicking off.
Thank you, John.
Pleasure, John.
And John.
Thanks, Casey.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/sundaynights with an S. Thank you for listening.